Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, another fantastic episode of the podcast to share with you today. We interviewed Aaron Walsh, who's one of our provider attorneys out of Nashville, Tennessee, but he's fresh to Nashville within the past year, moved his whole practice, which he'd been running for, I think it was 10 or 12 years or so, in Columbia, South Carolina, to Nashville just this last year. And he walks us through the transition. You know, a lot of attorneys have often considered, boy, I sure would like to, you know, live in another city or another state or another area, but, you know, hey, I've got this practice to run and maybe don't really make the transition because of that. But he's here to say that it is possible. It can be a lot of work on the front end and maybe some travel time, and he gives some great tips on maybe how to avoid some of the headache that he's had to address. But there's a lot of ways to do it, and he gives some real-world examples of how he has done it in the past year and is even still running a few cases in South Carolina at the moment, but he'll soon to be wrapped up with those. And so for those of you that might be considering making a transition to a new state or new city and opening up a new practice there and winding up your current practice, this is going to be a really valuable episode. We also talk a lot about layaway. Layaway is a new option that a lot of our attorneys have been offering, and that's just the ability to, you know, get clients moving forward with making payments on their case, even if they can't afford the full amount up front, and just making payments towards the balance and then filing it once the payments reach a certain threshold. And we've had a couple of lawyers that have come on the show and shared that they've been offering that option to a great degree of success. And he really unpacks that today and shares exactly how to explain it to the clients. And so far, it's been working extremely well for Aaron. And we also cover a lot of other tips. So let's get right into this episode. It's wide-ranging and lots to take away from. So this interview with Aaron Walsh, one of our provider attorneys out of Nashville, Tennessee. All right. Hey, Aaron, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks. How are you?
You know, I'm good, man. I'm really happy we're getting a chance to connect today. I think we've been working together for a number of months now, and from what I've heard, things have been going real smooth and certainly sending you a lot of clients. And so I'm really looking forward to hearing more about the story and how things have been going and the types of options you've been offering the clients. So I appreciate you taking the time today.
Sure, my pleasure.
Yeah. So maybe what you could do, Aaron, just to start us off is just give a little bit of background to, you know, how you got started practicing law and the region you serve and also the areas of law you cover.
Sure. I went to law school from 2000 to 2003. I had been for a little while after college working in sort of intermodal transportation, containerized shipping and things of that nature, which took me from Nashville, Tennessee, where I'm from and am now. But in the steamship industry, I had ended up working in Charleston such that South Carolina had become my home state. And so after a few years, I applied to and ended up going to South Carolina School of Law. Got out in 2003 and practiced exclusively in South Carolina until 2016, when I returned home to Nashville, Tennessee. My practice here is a solo practice focusing on pretty close to exclusively on family and domestic law. That was true of my practice in South Carolina as well, with the exception that I had a larger criminal law component there. I guess that's how I got to be here.
Yeah. So what made you make the transition from working in the steamship industry and, you know, working with containers and so forth to becoming a lawyer originally? Do you remember?
Sure. There was a number of things. Law school had always perhaps been a bit on my radar. I'm not sure how many political science majors never at least thought about it. And there's some lawyers in my family. My undergrad experience, it took me 5 years to get through with a GPA that it was fine, but I got better in law school, and it probably was best that I spend a little bit of time working. But to some extent, I knew I would probably go back to school, whether that would be a master's in public policy or law school. That part, I guess, I was not sure about until it played out. But I kind of knew I would go back. And there, 3 years working on a truck yard will make you want to go back to school if trucking is not in your blood, and it's not in my blood.
Yeah. Yeah. Fair enough. And so you were practicing in South Carolina. Did you say Charleston, or what part of South Carolina were you from? Practicing in?
Yeah, I started out practicing in Columbia, which is where the law school is. I'm somewhat traditional. I worked for a mid-sized insurance defense firm for a couple of years. And when that turned out not to be the best match for me, as probably many insurance associates discover, I did something completely different. I took a pretty big pay cut, became an assistant public defender, which I loved, to be honest. If I kind of was a trust fund guy, I would probably still be a public defender. But after a couple of years of that, so at this point, I'm 4 or 5 years out of law school and somehow decided I would do the shingle thing. And what you learn when you hang a shingle is a huge amount of the calls that come in are going to be about family law. I spent about a month saying, well, no, I don't really do that. And then my training from trucking years, honestly, whether we had a truck or not, we always had a truck. We always took the load. We'd cover it. And I guess that experience got into my head and I just started saying yes to the family law clients. And now close to 10 years later, I say no to about everything else. I once had a smart but cynical older lawyer tell me after about 7 or 8 years was how long it took before you got over the whatever it was that made you not want to call yourself a divorce lawyer. And it's true. All young lawyers are like, well, I do divorces, but I'm also this. After about 8 years, you'll get over that and you'll be like, yep, I'm a divorce lawyer, you know, custody, whatever, all those things. And that is about me. I did try murder last January, but I really think I'm kind of done with that for various reasons.
So what is it about family law that draws so many folks away from all these other areas and everyone inevitably ends up doing family law? And what is it about it for you that that has you being more specialized in it these days?
Well, I think the real answer is just that for, you know, kind of a retail lawyer, you know, not someone who gets clients from an insurance company or has some other, you know, amazing way to get clients. If you are just out there, it seems to me that pretty much the calls that you will get or the focus, you can be an injury attorney, you can do criminal work, or you can do divorce laws because, you know, in candor, when businesses need a lawyer, they kind of know who to call. I've done some business law, but family law is what people need, and they need it every day. They need it in a recession. They need it in good times and bad times. And if you embrace it, I know very few decent family court attorneys who really struggle so much with, you know, finding people that maybe want to hire them. It's more a matter of finding good clients, matching up well, and trying to represent, you know, clients that you can get along with and help. A flip side I know for a lot of attorneys is that, you know, in an insurance firm or something, I mean, my complaint with that, and it's certainly a good area of law, is I helped, you know, either corporations or wealthy people sort of fight over piles of money, and I had a relatively small part in it. And it can be fairly hard to feel important. And I can think of 20 areas of law that I would guess are kind of the same, but even the brokest or, you know, kind of the least appealing client in a way, their family court case is very important to them. And so that can kind of help with motivation, or at least in my case.
Yeah. And allows you to really, you know, develop a relationship with someone and serve them on a very personal and human level, you know, with issues that are very personal to them. Yeah.
And very real and very important. And, you know, in candor, I mean, a lot of lawyers, I think, although we're trained to speak, I think a lot of us in a way are kind of introverted and are not crazy about getting to know the clients. But ultimately, you kind of do when you learn to, you know, if you're an introvert, you still learn a way to talk to them. And when you really can help somebody with a custody thing or you know, get them some alimony when they didn't know how they were going to survive, it can be pretty rewarding. And then, like every kind of law, a lot of clients turn out to be jerks and you wish you'd never met them, but that's the job, and you do your job and you do it as best you can, and you don't do it because they're going to thank you. You just do it. But I like helping people, and helping Allstate sue, you know, Travelers for indemnification was never going to give me that feeling. And again, for people who do that, that is wonderful, but it was not going to be for me.
Yeah. We're going to get a call from a bunch of Allstate lawyers here in a minute going, hey, man.
Yeah, I know they're going to be mad. I'm going to single out, you know, of course.
Yeah, just kidding. Yeah,
subrogation, indemnification, all those words, I recall them from law school, but I deal with them rarely.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you're hitting on something I think that's important, and that is that, you know, unless you're like, you're going to be at the country club and working with businesses and you're in the, you know, old boy referral network, you know, individuals and families, they need family law, immigration, bankruptcy, and estate. I mean, these are the 3-4 areas we're going to be working on.
Sure.
These are everyday life events. This is what the family and parents and all kinds of any average working family is going to be dealing with day to day. So when it comes to serving, you know, the average folks, and this is the type of things they're dealing with.
Yeah. And the flip is that, you know, the lawyers that do advertise tend to mostly be injury lawyers. So even the people that are out there being pressed at potential clients largely don't do the area of law. I mean, if you happen to get hit by a car, great. But there's 100 lawyers fighting for that injury case. You don't, at least in my market or smaller markets, you don't see kind of divorce lawyers or most kind of criminal or bankruptcy of these areas. Not a lot of advertising. It's word of mouth, but if nobody you know knows a good attorney, you really don't know where to go. And that's, you know, more you guys side of it and connecting people and that making that connection is, as you know, there's a lot of companies that try to do it and, you know, offer leads, but you guys also know your numbers and that you're pretty successful with it. And the way you do it is working for, you know, both a lot of clients and it appears a lot of attorneys. So that's a good niche. And there we go.
No doubt. Well, you know, and you're in a bit of a, you have, a unique story. I mean, you were practicing in South Carolina. You got a lot of experience running your own, like you said, opening your own practice and running that in South Carolina. And then you had to essentially kind of start from scratch in a community you knew, but essentially maybe you had a few relationships here and there, and maybe you get your foot in the door, get going a little bit, but you had to start again. And so what might be really interesting is if you could walk us through what that was like to have to come back, and I'm curious also what brought you back to Nashville, if you want to share that, and then also take us through what you did to get your practice up and running again in a whole new city.
A bit of a combination of things. The move back, of course, I grew up in Nashville, and my family was here, and my mom and stepdad were certainly getting older. Their health was not so good, and so it was useful for them to have me and my family come back. 100 something people a day, according to various statistics, are moving to the Nashville area every day. So it's a place people want to be, and I had watched its growth. And certainly, you know, my wife would sometimes kind of ask me, half joking, why don't we live in Nashville exactly? And so, you know, but when you've got one bar down and office and all these things, it can be very daunting. So ultimately, we just decided we were going to do it. We got 3 kids, you know, but 2 of them are fairly young, and it was just a matter. And as it turns out, not to get into the morbid, after about a year of being back, my mom did pass about a month ago. So we got back just in time to do that. And that, for all of those reasons, it was good. But also, even with, you know, Tennessee has several more law schools than South Carolina, and I think has even added another one or two in the last few years that maybe it didn't need. There is still a demand just because of the growth. And again, you know, not to any lawyer who's been doing it for a while will tell you there's never really a lawyer surplus. There's a competent lawyer shortage, and I'm not knocking everybody, but it, you know, there's a lot. The fact there may be this many lawyers, this many law schools, doesn't necessarily mean there's not demand for a good and qualified. You can get to people. But I had a very hard time at first, absolutely, because, you know, chicken and egg, based on shutting down a fairly successful practice and packing up and moving, you know, I basically went from good revenue to, like, no revenue. I mean, one old friend from high school hired me on a contempt for his wife. A couple things trickled in, and I got a couple fees. But it really was, I mean, I didn't literally eat ramen noodles because I can't stand them, but it was very tight for a minute. And then, you know, things pick up a little bit. And then, you know, in candor, my unbundled relationship started at a pretty good time, and those leads picked up our revenue, you know, a good bit. At the same time, I was having some organic revenue growth, but certainly in my case, the unbundled referrals were a little bit of a shot in the arm. And we've been kind of cranking along at this point. It enabled me to get out of a kind of a virtual and home office scenario, which, not to knock it, I know that's increasingly popular. And if you kind of know how to do it, you can do very well that way. But I'm just old school enough. I like an office and a receptionist and a desk and all those things. So we got the revenue, we got the office, we got the, you know, sign on a busy road. And so the unbundled thing is still growing, and the, you know, just being back and being in the community is growing, and lots of new relationships, as well as, you know, the fact that you went to kindergarten through eighth grade with somebody is great. But if you haven't seen them since eighth grade, it does very little for you. But if you then, over a year or two, you know, see them either at events or even just on social media, like, oh yeah, Walsh, he's on Facebook, he's back, I like that Friday afternoon farmer's market too, he's a real person. And you know, people are reminded of you, and that process is ongoing. But it was tough. My first reaction would be to say I would never advise anybody to pack up a 10-year-old practice and move it. The flip side is, you know, if there's somewhere you really want to be,
maybe you should, because, you know, my smaller county in South Carolina wasn't home, and it was fine, and I was making good money, but I was never going to really, really love it. And possibly someone listening to this is somewhere they don't really love, and maybe they've got a bigger market in mind. And so it's hard. Be prepared for your ramen noodle period, so to speak. But it, you know, it can be done. And also in candor, if, you know, someone was planning a move and you know, had a, you would think, an unbundled lead generation, but some way to you know, get leads and things when they opened up, it can be done. Although, you know, I guess if I hadn't made it, I'd be dispatching trucks somewhere cussing about how it didn't work. But I think, you know, so long as somebody's looking at a growth area, one of any of the great cities in America that are growing or great markets, if you'll work hard and get some good leads, I think people can do it. So.
Yeah, we had another gentleman we've been working with for, gosh, a long, long time. He was out of El Paso. His name is Charles Skinner. He came on the podcast back in middle of January. Episode was called, I think, How to Relocate a Law Practice to a New Region. And he talked a lot about, you know, how to unwind, you know, a long-standing practice. And he was going back and forth because basically his wife moved, got a job in Dallas, you know, pretty quick, didn't have much notice. And so he was ready to move the whole thing. And he had to go back and forth and manage it. So maybe you could just kind of walk people through what it takes to, because I think there are a lot of attorneys out there that, you know, maybe they kind of like the city of living, but they there's somewhere else they may really prefer to live, but because of the fact they built up a practice and they got the referrals and they got all the things you got going, they could be really reluctant to make the jump. Certainly, you know, in your case, and Shirley and Charles's, by being able to tap into a lead generation service, it makes it a lot easier just to, you know, flip the switch and have clients in a new area. But there's a lot of steps involved with that. So maybe you can unpack just a little bit further what you had to do to unwind your practice in South Carolina as far as wrapping up cases, if you handed them off to some other attorneys you worked with, and then, you know, and then how long that took, and then maybe what you had to do to get it going in Nashville again.
Sure. It's still somewhat taking. The pro tip, which maybe this is not exactly what I did, the pro tip is plan it far enough in advance that as you're saving whatever money you can save for your move, you can save some money either to, you know, of course, if people have unearned retainers, you should be able to refund them out of trust. You know, some people, however, are working on earned upon receipt retainers, and that's hard. The pro tip would be have enough money to terminate everybody, give them their money back, end on good terms, and cleanly. Probably nobody does this, me included. Mine was sort of a hybrid. I sent a letter to everybody, and I gave them lots of notice about my plans. I said, you know, but what I did, and it has to do with me, and it violates the pro tip. So is I kind of told people that, you know, so long as you have paid your bill and you're willing to pay your bill, I'll stay on your case if you want me. I pretty much advise people, you may be more comfortable someone whose office is in the same state as you, South Carolina, but, you know, we've come this far together, and if you really want me, I'll stay. And so as a result of that decision that perhaps I would make differently next time, to be honest, I still have, I think, 5 or 6 South Carolina cases. And in fact, on Monday, of all things, I will appear in front of the South Carolina Court of Appeals for oral argument. This is a money loser. I will never really get paid for that time on any of these cases, because obviously, even if I'm charging for what I'm doing there, I can't charge people a 12-hour round trip, and I don't. So it's a money loser, but I, you know, reputation matters. And though I've left that place, I didn't want to leave it as the guy who left people in a lurch. So that was difficult. I have been up and down the road to South Carolina. It was bad at first, but at first also I was still getting revenue in South Carolina. So, and not so much in Tennessee. And I was really up and down the road. As those cases started to close out, that ratio really switched. At this point, every time I go to Tennessee, pretty much it's kind of a money loser, but I'm just wrapping it up ethically. And it, you know, helps for me. My wife and her family are all from there. So at least I can usually tack it onto a weekend or, you know, in some way make it not just a 13, 14 hour round trip for a 2 hour hearing, which is tough. But realistically, you know, an in-state move, I guess for most states, that wouldn't be that big of a deal. Dallas to El Paso is probably about as far as South Carolina to Nashville. And I'm sure that guy, you know, sort of said the same. The back and forth was more of it and more difficult than he probably expected. I would have liked to have planned that a little better, but you know, you do what you have to do. And if you got court somewhere, you either cover it or you appear yourself. And if appearing yourself means you drive 6 hours to do it, you drive 6 hours to do it. Anyone listening that practices law knows it's kind of unlike. I mean, no CPA would do that, but our business is a little different. And so that was a great question, because that is
really a difficult part of that. I'm lucky to be about done. Like I said, I think I have 5 or 6 South Carolina cases, and probably 3 or 4 of them have trial dates. You know, they're just wrapping them up. But the smart and short answer is, get out, refund people their referral, get them a new lawyer, and leave as cleanly as possible is the advice.
Yeah, and try not to
try
keep
not
the
to do what I do, do what I say, not yeah. what I do. Yeah.
Well, I mean, I commend you for, you know, from an integrity standpoint, being willing to go to bat on your word and continue to help those folks, even though it's a real slap to get down there and do it, but you're doing it, and so that says a lot about your willingness to honor your commitments to folks.
And certainly, I mean, not by name, but, you know, having some good friends in the market you leave who, you know, they're not going to try their case for you, but can at least stand in on a 5-minute status conference helps a lot. You know, if you, and again, I mean, anybody who's probably in a spot to move, hopefully they've made a few friends, because you will either need a lot of retainer money to pay people, or some friends who will help you out. You know, certainly in the place you're leaving, ideally in both spots, you know. But you know, that again, it's just a matter of doing it and being careful with your scheduling, which it's supposed to be anyways. And I don't know, no magic advice there. It's kind of the same as running a small practice anywhere. Just your different courts are much farther apart.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and this is good advice, because, you know, you've done it. There's the way to do it, and it was clear to you, and then you've done it a little bit differently. And you know, you've had to, you know, go the extra mile to make it happen. And, you know, so attorneys can really now think through when they're going to make that transition, how to do it. Right. And hopefully, you know, do it in the best way possible, where they're maybe not having to take so much time to maintain a previous practice. So it's a lesson learned either way.
Right.
And if they do, they know what they're in for. So
that's right. I mean, I it'd be hard for me to picture someone, even the most best planning. I mean, it'd be hard for me to imagine not having to go back and forth for 3 or 4 months. I have probably done it now for a little more than a year. And that was perhaps a bit of an aspect of some poor planning on my part, but also the nature of a case. I mean, maybe you can go to trial in a year, maybe not. And maybe you can control that and push it along and take your depositions, and maybe you can't, you know, so that's, it certainly ethically, so long as, you know, I'd given people retainers back, I wouldn't have gotten any trouble for backing out of a case that I was 3 file boxes into, but I just, that to me, you know, like I said, I would have done it to a insurance company client, but to a real person who's been working with me for 3 file boxes, me as an individual, I couldn't send them on their way if they didn't want to go on their way. But that's a choice you make, and as long as you do it ethically, there's no wrong choice. You know.
Yep. Yeah, it just means you might be spending a little bit more time in a car than you might have envisioned. But hey, you know, you can catch
that's
up on
it.
Old Unbundled Attorney Mastermind podcast episodes while you're in it. So it'll be just
absolutely,
because
you know, there's several good ones to listen to. There you go.
Exactly. Maybe the one about how to relocate your practice without having to do that.
that's a good place to start.
All right, cool. Well, hey, I mean, you've made the transition. You've done so successfully. I mean, it sounded like you had, you know, some slow times, but certainly, you know, with the efforts you did to get it up and running, and our, you know, partnership and working together, sending you leads has certainly helped a lot. So let's talk about how things have been since you got in Nashville, and then we started working together, and we can talk and start to unpack how it is you're serving the clients that we've been sending you. I believe we started. So you when was it that you moved to Nashville? So you said about
I probably showed here, you know, kind of as a presence from about April of last year. I would say more towards the middle of the summer is when the switch really got flipped. I think maybe July or August, I just absolutely refused to take anything new in South Carolina. So I guess I'd have to look and see when I actually got sworn in Tennessee, probably December of 15 or January of 16. But then, that's a whole different process, obviously. But I'd say, you know, at this point, I've been here full time about a year would be close enough for government work, as they say.
Yeah. And from the legal side, as far as getting licensed in Tennessee and get familiar with the local courts, were you, you know, researching and kind of getting ready, did you have to, first of all, retake the bar for Tennessee?
I did not. I was able to be admitted by motion, which was absolutely fantastic. You had to have a bunch of referrals, and you have to do the whole application again, and, you know, list everywhere you've lived for 20 years, like you remember your college addresses and all that stuff. But I was able to get admitted by motion. And although, don't quote me, someone actually told me that very soon after I did that, Tennessee maybe changed their rule. And maybe you can't do that anymore. Although, again, don't quote me. So my joke, of course, is that they did that because of me, although I don't believe that for a second. And every time I cross up, I think I kind of said something earlier before we were talking that 12B motion in Tennessee is a 12.02 motion. It's completely different. And every time I kind of say something wrong or, you know, sort of accidentally argue a rule the way it is in South Carolina, I always kind of have a joke with my wife. I'm like, you know, they really probably should have made me take a bar exam. although, I, you know, 15 years in, it's... You learn to research the differences, but I was somewhat fortunate they did not make me sit for another 2-day test.
Well, yeah, it's a good thing to look into if you're looking at making a move to a different state or a different local bar, if there's a possibility of being able to be admitted by motion, or if you're going to be, you know, stuck going, you know, sitting the test.
Sure.
Again, so.
And it makes it, you know, but, and if you're going to do the motion thing, I mean, I just sort of, fortunately or unfortunately, I had I joke about the insurance defense practice, but I had a couple of wonderful, wonderful teachers in that firm. And one of them, you know, he just, every single year when we'd get that new rule book, he would just sit there in his office and he'd read the rule book, and then he'd make the associates do the same. And I pretty much still do that every year, which I, you know, maybe not as closely as the first year, because between that old partner and my contracts professor with his quote of, if you don't read the footnotes, your children will starve. I'm just always reminded of that. And I've won plenty of hearings at this point because I knew the rules just a little bit better than the other guy. And I've lost some because maybe I didn't know them quite as well. Ultimately, I guess substantive law is more interesting and more, you know, more like the exciting memos of law you get to write as a clerk, but at least in my area of work, the rules are probably more important than the substantive law half the time. And if they don't make you take a bar exam, you can be weak there. So, again, kind of the pro tip, if you're able to get in by motion, boy, learn those rules, because the lawyers you're up against will have been dealing with them every day for 10, 30 years. And they'll club you with them if you're the new guy, whether you're new, whether you're really new or just new to. And Tennessee's great, too, because they allow local rules. South Carolina, for whatever reason, really didn't. Tennessee has some amazing amount of counties, like 90-something, because of the hilly topography. And there's all this kind of reason that has so many counties, and they allow local rules. So you got to know, you got to know everything to dabble. But, you know, again, that's the job. And if you're going to go to, you know, Smith County, you better learn the Smith County local rules. Because, again, the guys that live and practice every day in Smith County, they know them. And they're waiting for you to come down from, you know, the city and not know their rules.
Yeah.
So, yeah, those tips have very little to do with my unbundled experience. It's kind of general tips, which anybody could give, you know. But
nothing wrong with that. I mean, we've been on the topic of, you know, how to get up to speed in a new region here. So
that's right.
Certainly
that's
a factor of it. And learning the rules is part and parcel, especially, like you said, when you're working in a region in which local rules are you know, an important aspect of the law there, you know, and the way cases are going to be heard and decided. So certainly getting up to speed. And that's something that Charles talked about is, you know, he went into and met the judges and got to know the clerks and really took some time to get to know that new local court and everything that was on it. He talked for a while on the value
there. I bet El Paso and Dallas seem like they're almost in two different states. I mean, just from some limited childhood time in Texas, you know, very different regions, different, and, you know, the vastness of that state probably puts Tennessee's 96 counties to shame. But he's exactly right. You know, but the reality is, if you have clients and you are, you know, if you got two cases, nobody wants to sit and read that rule book. I mean, maybe they should. They don't want to. If you've got 20, 30, 40 cases with rules you need to look up, you'll be in there regardless. You don't need some, you know, hypothetical advice to read the rules if you've got clients. And so, again, you know, finding the right lead source, you know, and in my case, I've been successful with Unbundled. Not to knock anybody else, but I can speak for me, and I've been successful with you guys, and that, you know, that's real world motivation. I'm in juvenile court tomorrow. How do I file this financial declaration? I better look. That'll get you there too.
Yeah, it has a great way of motivating you to, you know, late in the evening when you realize you got to file something and you're going to be there in the morning to figure out what the heck you're doing as you go along.
And,
And try not to make it seem like you did it.
I got to figure something out for a motion to compel tomorrow. That's a little bit of a wrinkle. And I'm going to eat some dinner and then, you know, put in the evening hours that I'm sure almost anyone listening is pretty familiar with.
Yeah, no doubt.
Again, you know, you're at home. Maybe you drink a cup of coffee, or if you're so inclined, maybe you have a single cold beer and you do some research, and it could be a lot worse.
Yeah. Okay, so you get kind of settled in the summer. I think we entered the fray early November of 2016. We started sending you some leads. So maybe walk us through maybe what was different for you, or if anything at all, in the way in which you were working these leads as opposed to what you've been used to up till then, and some of the strategies you started to implement to, you know, start to have some success based on either our suggestions or what you found to be working well for you.
Sure. I mean, I just think the biggest thing that probably was not necessarily a surprise to me, but a change, and is probably something you all hear, you know, regularly, is it's a pretty good volume. I mean, at least in my market, you know, I don't necessarily get some number per day, but it's a pretty good volume. And if you are used to, you know, even kind of in a very busy sort of organic growth situation like I had in South Carolina, where in Canada, I really had no organized marketing. I just kind of knew a lot of people, it seemed like. You know, you get a certain pace of calls and clients and meetings, and if it's a satisfactory pace, you probably lock into it. I would anticipate that for all but just the very busiest solos or small firm lawyers, the pace of unbundled referrals, or not referrals, leads, is faster. That probably, and so you've got to sort of adapt your daytime, you know, whether you set a time to call people or whether you, you know, try to just call them immediately. I mean, there's different ways to do that. And I'll be honest, I've tweaked several of them. I've gone from being a got to call them within 15 minutes if possible to, you know, people really only answer certain times during the day, at least employed people. And that's, you know, probably most of them, back to, I like calling it at, you know, lunchtime and 5 o'clock, but I'm missing a few people that I didn't call in the first 20 minutes. And so now I'm probably a little bit of a hybrid. I mean, I try to call them very quickly. And if for whatever reason I'm not able to, then I go for kind of what I've found to be kind of the sweeter spots, which are, you know, maybe 8 to 9 a.m., lunch, 5 to 6 p.m., you know, kind of when people are maybe not sitting at a desk or, you know, in a factory line or in a restaurant or wherever it is they are, where they're not really supposed to be on their cell phone talking to a lawyer.
Right.
So I've combined those two, but I think that pace, I mean, if you, again, outside of the very busiest solo, you know, getting 3, 4, 5, you know, leads in a day, people who want to talk to a lawyer, is probably a big adjustment for anybody. And, you know, in candor, you'll have days, if you're busy, if you had 30 calls last week and you signed up 15, 20 people and you've got 20 new cases and you're doing pleadings, you know, if you get that kind of leads the next week, you know, you might miss a couple, and you just, you keep on working with your sort of internal, you know, if you got assistants or whatever you're doing, and you, and I would, you know, certainly my unbundled rep and has had some really good suggestions and able to share kind of other people's experiences that, you know, you don't always have to reinvent the wheel. Just like, who in the world writes their own brand new complaint? You ask around, hey, anybody got a complaint for this? And you make it fit for you. Similar, he's had some great advice. And then in candor, you know, he suggested a couple of things that for my particular little niche, I just didn't find to work as well as the rest. But overall, I mean, I think these, you know, the biggest things are reaching people fairly quickly. They don't expect you to call them in 5 or 10 minutes. But if you've waited 5 or 10 days, you might pick up a scrap client, but they're going to be gone. You got to call them timely, and you got to, you know, be able to connect with them a little bit on the phone and go to the next step of either a longer phone interview or having them come to your office or, you know, whatever's next. Some of that probably you can't teach. You just learn it. I mean, no offense to say, I may have a couple closing tricks that a brand new lawyer doesn't have. But on the flip side, I bet there's some brand new lawyers who are killing me, because they probably just are. I have no doubt of that. So it's you have to make it work for you. But I think just reaching these people and being, you know, knowledgeable enough. I mean, you don't have to know the detailed answer to every question, because honestly, if you're getting into the detailed questions in your first call, you need to tweak it anyways. It's deeper than you need to go. You know, they want to know that you have a decent knowledge of the area law you're talking about. You know, whether you tell them a war story or just tell them a little bit about yourself. And you know, my way, I kind of, when they call, if I don't have, you know, 30 minutes, I try to set them up for a pretty quick phone call back and get, you know, not necessarily the 30, 40 minutes, not necessarily a phone consult, but a little bit more of a phone call. And then from that, I see if they're probably better suited to a real phone consult. I, again, if it's convenient for people, I like to get them in my office. Just I've kind of got a feeling that it's a little harder to kind of say no to somebody in person, and not in a salesman sense, but if they sit in your office and meet you for 30 minutes, I just find they're maybe a little more likely to take the next step than being on the phone with you for 30 minutes. That said, people are busy, and if they just want to talk on the phone and use a computer and email and PDFs because it's 2017, you want to be able to respond to that guy too. You know, well, no, there's no real need for you to come here. I make that available to you. A lot of clients want to see my face. If you're good, I'm good. I'll send you a retainer agreement. We'll send you a LawPay link. Let's go. You know, you certainly want to be able to go both ways. I like the face-to-face, but I have no doubt that there's people who've really refined their phone consults to the point that probably hardly anybody comes to see them. And nothing wrong with that either if it works.
Yeah, it's interesting. We certainly have a mixed bag. A lot of folks that they like to work from home and kind of mix up where they're at working from a location and do a lot of the enrollments over the phone. And then a lot of the lawyers that, like you said, they want to have them come in the office and they want to meet the person too. And the people like to meet them. And I think it also has a lot to do with the locale and the region. And like you said, the business of the folks,
right.
You know, one of the things, right. and how much traffic there is on the roads in the city that you live in.
You know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and a 27-year-old network engineer is probably cool looking you up online and looking at your reviews and everything else. A 57-year-old line cook, you know, or something, he wants to look you in the eye. And that's just, you start to get a feel for that. And I'm sure I still get it wrong some, of course, but you try to get the feel and you try to give them the option, really. I mean, that's how I handle it. It's like, you know, sir, I'm old school. I kind of like to meet people in person, but I understand traffic is bad and you got these kids and a life. And if it's, you know, if you'd rather get started, I'm not going to drag you in here for nothing. Some version of that. And I'm sure everybody's got some version they use. And that's about mine, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. We had Bob Mullenweg, who's one of our providers out of Albuquerque. He's a state lawyer that's been practicing for, I think, 36 some odd years or something like that. And he talked about that, how he kind of evaluates what he would call the old school clients versus new school. And based upon that, makes a determination whether they need to come in and sit down and be and kind of, you know, have that belly to belly interaction versus, like you said, the 30-year-old that's had a cell phone, you know, a smartphone, you know, from the, you know, basically from when they got out of high school, and they like to do things quick, click a button, make the payment, and don't necessarily need to make a decision in person. And so evaluating that aspect is certainly going to dictate, if you can effectively evaluate that aspect, it's going to dictate whether you need to have them come in the office or not.
Right. Yes. Yeah. And that's a segue to that. Maybe not the perfect one, but pretty good. I think that one thing that I noticed as I got more into working with the unbundled leads and getting into this, I was never a big fan. I mean, I don't think a website or a Facebook page or SEO, I'm just not a big believer in any of that. In a larger sense, the way that unbundled moves their search results up, that's fine. But on an individual basis, I've just not found it to be that useful. But what I will say is anybody who signs up with Unbundled, what they will see once the switch gets turned or whatever, if they have a website, Facebook, their views will go through the roof. So you've got to have enough of a good online presence that when people then look you up, they say, oh, yeah, this looks pretty good, which is different from like, oh, my website's going to get me clients, right? It won't. But you definitely, once they get there, you want them to have enough information to make a good decision. And, you know, it's although a bit corny, the very, very kind Facebook testimonials that so many people have written for me. I mean, people come in, they're like, I quit reading after 10 good reviews or whatever. And that's great. And it takes a little time to build that up. And, you know, kind of as a separate thing, you never want to ask clients for testimonials. But at the end of representation, I don't think there's anything wrong with saying, you know, I'm not asking you to do this, but should you want to say something about your experience, here's a link. And if not, hey, great. Thank you so much. And a lot of people will, at least if they're happy, you know, if you're pretty sure someone's leaving your office 2/3 ticked off, maybe don't give them the link, but that should always be a small percentage of your clients. If not, you got a bigger problem than marketing. I think that my experience is that even, you know, coming through the lead generation, these people, when they get my information, the first thing most of them do is look me up online. And so you do want to have enough of a good online presence that you don't lose people. But I think focusing on that, I don't know if a website ever got anyone really a client, at least not in the solo small firm world, maybe somewhere out there, but not for me.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it does. It's just, it is a, a very specific skill set. What you can do is you can get traffic, but you know, I agree with you that doing the SEO, which is basically getting better positioning in organically right. in the search rankings, you don't have a chance to compete against Avvo and lawyers.com and guys that have been around nope. for doing this for 20 years and spend $10,000 plus $30,000-$40,000 a month to stay where they're at.
Right.
So, you know, I think you're absolutely right that the website, the reviews, it's like a check mark. Okay, there's some social proof that this guy, you know, is a solid guy. He cares about his clients, and you know, he's reasonable and so forth.
Oh,
and
look, then, his kid's cute. Look, he's a cute kid. You know, whatever. Whatever
yeah,
you
they
have
can,
on there,
they can relate.
I don't have my kids.
They can relate.
But, you know,
yeah,
that's right. Sure. Yeah, and the testimonials. I mean, I think some people really read those, and if they see somebody, you know, on Facebook, your website, who kind of looks like them, and I don't know if I mean physically, but you know, in some way looks like them, saying this guy is all right. He, you know, I didn't want to hire a lawyer. This process is terrible. And you know what? It's still terrible, but Walsh was okay. That's a great recommendation. I mean, someone who says, "Oh, he made this whole thing painless," like, what a lie. There's no painless divorce. I never made anybody's divorce painless. I never claimed to. But you know, can I make it as smooth as it can be? I hope so. And that's, you know, that's the pitch, I guess. So if you're selling painless, you're lying.
Yeah, no doubt. It's more just it's a credibility. Like it's helping them in the decision making process, but isn't necessarily you know, closing the deal for you for sure.
Yeah, I love when clients reconcile. They're like, "I hope you're not mad." I'm like, "Man, that's great. You're working on your marriage." I'm not just like pro divorce. It doesn't really matter. But if you're gonna do it, you got a right to do it, and you know, you have a right to have someone help you through it. But if there's a way around it, that's also, you know, that's great. And I think people pick up on that. I'm not, you know, it's not about me or how I feel about anything. I'm happy when people stay married, but it's not always possible.
Yeah. Well, yeah. So I want to circle back on something you touched on, which is, you know, we've had a lot of lawyers that have come on the podcast and experienced what I guess what we would call, you know, very rapid growth, you know, because, you know, like you said, when you come on board with a lead generation company, certainly like ours, I can't speak for any others, but, you know, we usually are going to bring some volume especially if it's a region that we're opening up and so forth. So, you know, and that happens overnight. I mean, the next day, you know, I'm looking at your account real quick here, and you've gotten something like 340 or 360 some odd leads in 5 months. So doing a quick bit of math, that's about 60, 70 leads a month or about 10, 15 leads a week. So they're coming in quick and they're coming in from day one. And so what are some of the things that you've had to do? You mentioned, you know, some staff and some support and so forth. You know, there was another episode, scaling up your practice, you know, small, solo practice practitioner to small firm in less than 3 months. Great episode, but it was, man, they were knocking down the walls. They were hiring new lawyers. I mean, it was crazy. And I don't know if you had to knock down walls, but certainly you got to adjust because real quick, you figure out, man, I'm going to get swamped and I can't do this all myself. If I'm going to keep bringing in 15 this week and then 15 next week and then another 15 the next week, they really start to stack up and you got to, you know, serve the ones from the first week and then the serve ones from the second, but you got new ones coming in. So how have you made that, got over that hump?
Well, you know, some of the little things kind of in no particular order. I mean, one thing is if you can, you know, although I will tell you, I still believe that more people will no show for appointments a week out than appointments 2 days out. You know, the reality is if you've talked to them and you've kind of locked them in, you know, you use your scheduling, use your time. Don't, you know, if you can't get someone in the next day, it doesn't necessarily do you any good to get them in the next day and then not be able to do something. I mean, it helps you in the short term. But I also, I mean, I believe in staff. I mean, if you don't have funds, I mean, you do what you have to do. But to me, the idea, like, I believe in, even if it's not minimum wage anymore, but even if it's just a receptionist to get the phone in a physical office, I just think that helps a lot. I mean, you can be virtual, you can be at home, you can be wherever. But the flip side of that is probably you will be missing things. And, you know, again, train your staff. Don't have them giving legal advice. But the reality is a lot of people would just as soon talk to your assistant as you in the first place. It's cheaper. And all they want to know is, when's court? Did that paper go out? They don't need you. But if you don't have staff, you have to take that call. And sure, I mean, you can maybe still bill it as a 0.1 call or whatever, even though really you just kind of did something clerical. But you're better off being freed up to do what you can do. That's chicken or the egg. I mean, you got to get some revenue to hire somebody, but I don't see. And again, if I listen to some podcasts, I probably pick up some tips and say, "Oh, well, that's a great idea." But I don't see how you can maintain much revenue without some staff at some point. You have to have them, whether that's, you know, kind of a full paralegal or more of a receptionist. I find an area where most either solo or newer attorneys really could probably use some help. Don't be a bookkeeper. I mean, look at your books. But if you're not a bookkeeper, don't be a bookkeeper. Be a lawyer. you maybe could be a legal secretary as a lawyer, but you can't be a bookkeeper, not unless you are one. And you'll get in trouble, and you know, you'll have IRS liens and things that'll stop you before you get started. And that's, you know, you have to have help in place for that. And again, it is that chicken or the egg, but if you've got leads, now, I mean, if you don't have anyone calling you, maybe you can't make that gamble. But if you got 10 people coming to see you in a week, you know, that's the week to hire a receptionist. Take a chance. Do a $8 an hour probationary, $9, you know, $400 or $500 for the week. You know, you might have to come up with that money, because you will close, I don't know, you might close an extra 2 or 3 out of 10 people being properly staffed. And so the numbers, they fix themselves, but you know, you do have to get there. And, you know, again, it's nothing against a satellite or home office approach. At the very least, I think you must have a virtual receptionist. Somebody's got to answer that phone. I hate voicemail. Firm where I started, partners didn't even have voicemail. They just wouldn't allow it. So again, that's a little bit old school and probably not realistic, but as little as somebody's got to leave you a voicemail message, I think the better. Have a person who can write it down and email it to you, you know, but at least they know they talked to Kathy or Bill or whomever it is. And you know, adding attorneys, I mean, that's a bigger step, and I've kind of decided not to, but it's certainly not a bad idea if you feel comfortable supervising someone, you know, either also doing your work and supervising, or, you know, if you've got so many calls that you think you can really rain make all day and supervise a team. I mean, don't be scared to try it if you think you can do it. I've kind of resisted partnering up and things, and you know, maybe that's a mistake and maybe not. I like the flexibility. I like, you know, I don't want to worry about dividing up revenues. If there's profit, I pretty much know who gets it. But I mean, if realistically, if somebody's got 10 or 15 appointments coming in per week, that probably is a person who quickly needs an associate or a partner. And I, you know, I know you guys have done some previous things about how to really go about staffing up. So, and I'm probably not the best expert in that. I mean, it's my paralegal is also my wife, and we got to, you know, someone does help with the books. I take my own advice. And you know, but you've got to have office staff, I think, because if you are doing the copying and stuff, even if you're billing somebody at your rate, which maybe you shouldn't be, you just can't get enough done in the day, I don't think, unless you want to work a 12-hour day every day. And I have 3 kids. I do not want to do that. At least, you know, I mean, if you give me a job in the State Department, fly me around the world, maybe, you know, for the excitement. But solo law firm, 12 hours a day, to me, is kind of no thanks. Not to say some days you don't do that, but that's, I think, not having enough people to help you is how lawyers get stuck in that rut. I'm a big believer in staff, even though it, you know, it cuts into your short-term profits, and maybe you keep the used car an extra year or something, but I think it's a better choice. Although, you know, everyone's got to do what works for their economics, but, you know, if you, especially, I mean, and even if you've got a little bit of staff to go from, you know, 2-3 calls a week to 10 or 15, you'll have to make some changes. And kind of, like I said, with mine is, you know, I really try to kind of have a process that the leads come in, although largely paperless. I do print mine so I can make, you know, and I just make my notes right on there. Called, left a voicemail, emailed. Also in my practice management software, I create a contact for each lead and can kind of log that call. And that's some extra time, right? Anyone who's ever worked with one of these softwares are like, oh, every time you create a contact and phone call, it's an extra. True, it is. But again, at the end of the year, you know, I mean, if I looked at mine, I've got 300 and whatever number you said, 300 something contacts now in my unbundled attorney file matter, you know, and I can, I'm not going to say that every phone call necessarily makes it in there, though it's supposed to, like every file. And you know, you just keep up as best you can, whatever method. I'm a believer in management software. I know some of the older attorneys, other people like, you can do that in Word and Notepad just as well. Okay, great. If you can, that's awesome. I like to have one place for it. You know, to each their own, but have a system and just, you know, and then the red is like the professor said, read the footnotes. Whether that's the law or whether that's people's problems, I mean, just get down in the details and, you know, that part. Now you're back to the old, you know, work hard, get up early advice, which is still true.
Yep, no doubt. Yeah, and systems are important, you know, especially if, you know, one of the things about lead generation specifically is, you know, it's very consistent. You know, it's like, it's just, you know, you're going to get roughly the same amount of leads. It gradually goes up, you know, as we continue to do what we do well, and you know, that's going to keep improving. But you know, you can pretty much rely on it. They come in the same way, very similar types of issues. And so you can start to develop a system for, you know, getting the clients in, and you can have a very similar templates over time, similar types of documents, and you can start to develop a process that you can, you know, have staff learn how to implement some of those components. And I think, you know, some attorneys, depending again on economics and the volume of clients, it kind of does cost you money if you're not having staff handle business tasks that are low value. because that just means that you're not able to handle the higher value, more of the handle value tasks, higher value tasks, you know, that you're, you know, you went to law school to be able to bill at those rates, you know? So
that's right.
If you're stuck doing, answering the phone or doing tax, faxes and so forth, then it just takes away from your capacity to be able to serve more clients or grow the firm or scale the firm to another level. So, you know, even if, you know, where you're at, you're doing all that stuff, you're limiting, I would think that you're limiting yourself if, again, you can, you know, tap into leads or build up your clientele to the point where, you know, you've got enough people coming in where you can keep growing it. So that's sage advice. And we're certainly one of the things we're working on in the back end. I don't know, by the time this podcast episode goes out, we're going to be integrated with Lexicata here pretty soon, which means that, you know, all the leads we're going to be able to automatically post right into a Lexicata account, where all those contacts are immediately created, and you got the matter and all that stuff. And that's key, because it's all there. You've got, you know, templates and emails that can go out automatically, and then it goes right into Clio, and you can keep track of all your stuff. You can set reminders and really start to keep things organized. It does take a few minutes here and there to maintain it, but, you know, that way you're not missing making mistakes and missing deadlines and all that kind of stuff. So, and the more you streamline the practice and more you streamline the doc prep and you have assistance from staff, usually you're moving in the direction of having a higher effective hourly rate, or, you know, your average billable time is going up. So, you know, and that's nowadays, that's certainly a direction you want to be going.
That's it. Well, it's, you know, somebody, it was pointed out to me very obvious, very early, you know, you can either increase your hours or you can increase your rate, and effective rate is key. I mean, you can say you charge $350 an hour all day long. If you're collecting $150, you charge $150. you know, and so that effective rate, and for me, I would just soon like to work on that effective rate more so than number of hours, because past 40 or 50, you know, you about hit a wall there. So, you know, absolutely. That really is the key. And then if you really are at a point when you're billing 40 or, you know, close to 40 or more hours per week at your desire, if you're really at your desired rate, you know, 250, 300, 200, whatever, then absolutely. I think then you really got to look at staffing up. You know, I would say even as busy as I am, realistically, do I bill 40 quality hours week in, week out? Not necessarily. You know, you try, but, you know, that's kind of the target. And that's for me a goal. And whatever that comes to in revenue per week, like at that point, it would be pretty obviously time to look at another lawyer. And I'm you know, possibly had I not moved, I would be there. That was not necessarily a setback, but a change. But I could pretty easily see that coming in the next 12 months or so, based on where the numbers are now.
Yeah. Well, it seems like you're going to have two bonuses. One, you're going to eventually be in a position where you're, you know, killing even on another level of your practice, and also you're going to be in Nashville, so you're going to have both of those birds stuck.
You know, yeah, it's nice to be home. It really is.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, hey, this has been just a real, real great exploration. It's really interesting to, because it's so fresh, you know, to unpack, you know, how you've been able to make that transition and staff up. I'd love to get into the details some other time on, you know, exactly who you hired and at what point, and the secretary and the paralegal. So maybe we can do a round two some other time. But I guess maybe the last question I'll just ask is, you know, you 300 some odd leads, you know, certainly in the beginning you have a specific process, and then you gradually make some improvements and make some adjustments. Is there anything that sticks out to you, you know, after 6 months of doing this or so, 6-7 months, where you look back and was a real kind of turning point for you, or something that you took away or learned in the process that you feel was one of the biggest, you know, leverage points of making this thing work better than it did before, if anything?
Yeah, and it was a little thing, and it was almost, you know, probably in terms of one decision that maybe had the biggest impact is, you know, I'd been working with people and trying to quote payment plans or looking at unbundled, but there was a population of people who just never could get their numbers right. And by making the simple switch to allowing people to kind of more or less lay away that initial retainer, and you just agree, I'm not filing anything until you hit whatever number. It's a small thing, and you just keep putting your trust account. And that ability, you know, let's say you're getting $1,000 minimum retainer for full representation, you know, there's no way I can do that. I can give you 500. And probably without thinking, I sent a few of those people away before I said, no, well, fine, give me 500. And then next week, give me 100. And when you're at 1,000, keep giving me, you know, the 100 a week, and we'll go ahead and file your papers. And then they're on a payment plan. You know, you got to be careful with that. You don't want to get into a $10,000 contested custody case for somebody who couldn't come up with $500, because you know how that's going to end. But, you know, like I said, you can move the case along, or you can, I won't say put the brakes on. I don't know if that's ethical, but you don't have to rush everything. And, you know, if through that process you think somebody's going to be able to keep making those payments, you can probably pick up some clients on the margin that were going to say no. And, you know, a grateful client is a, in my experience, is more likely to give more organic referrals. I can love a lead service all day, but I still kind of believe no lead can match someone telling their cousin, best friend, church mate, man, Aaron Walsh is the best lawyer you can hire. He's great. He did me right. That, you know, that's just a totally different thing. It's not a matter of comparing apples to apples. That's apples and oranges. But the clients that had a hard time getting you, if they really feel like you went out of your way to help them, they're great referral sources. And you know, unfortunately, those referrals may also, again, be people that kind of struggle with cash. But you know, part of this whole system is figuring ways to try to make it work for those people, not just the $2,500 people that every lawyer will make it work for. Everybody knows how to take a $2,500 retainer and do work. That requires no particular, you know, process. That'd be my closing thought on that.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And those leads become referrals. The layaway is that, you know, we've seen a lot of lawyers, you know, I think it was Andrew Burgess who came on, law school graduate to 65 new paying clients in 3 months. Exploded his practice. And we're going, what the heck? And one of the things he said was, look, you know, if the guy comes in the door and he's got $250 in the pocket and I know it's going to cost at least $1,000 to get all the documents done and pay the filing fee and get done, why turn that gentleman away? Give him a structure on how he can start paying towards this process. Because the reality is, and we all know it, you know, folks that have challenges with finances and, you know, are limited means, usually they're not so good about managing money. And so if you're able to give them a structure on here's the payments, and also, I don't know if you're doing this in LawPay where you set up the automatic payments and it just kind of comes out. Tell me if I'm wrong, but it seems like people are really grateful for knowing that every day, even if they're limited means, they're moving towards getting something done.
They seem to like it, and we do LawPay. We like the secure link and the recurring payments. We've been real happy with that.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, just to finalize that point, so basically they're, If you've got a flat rate, if the person doesn't have the amount right then and there, rather than saying, okay, well, just give me a call when you get the funds, just say, okay, well, can you just maybe walk through what do you say to that person? We'll just unpack that briefly and then we'll wrap her up for today.
So let's say it's $1,000, and maybe it's a full retainer case that, you know, what you wanted to get was $1,000 down and $100 a week. I don't know. Let's say, and you know, the $100 a week is maybe for me more of the paradigm is able to $100 a week. Ooh, that part's no problem. $1,000, man. I don't know. It's not tax time. That's not going to work. I bring this home every 2 weeks. I'm never going to have $1,000 extra. That's fine. Are you ever going to have $250 extra? Probably. All right. Bring me that. We'll start the $100, you know, and what I do is just put in my retainer agreement, you know, they've got to hit a certain number, whether it's $1,000 or you cut them a little break. $800-$900, and at that point, I'm going to file your papers, and we're going to move on with this. It's really just a matter of letting them, you know, instead of saying, well, I'm going to save my money up and call you back. Well, why don't you save it up with me? I got a trust account. That's a better account than you got. I promise. You know, I'll hold it. And if for some reason, you know, you can't pull the trigger, I'll give it back to you, except for, you know, I might bill you for the time we've spent and just have that in your retainer, you know, the hour you sat with them or whatever. You know, I'm not obliged to do that for free, but there's no real risk. And again, as long as you, you know, keep it segregated, there's no risk for the lawyer. The worst thing you do is, you know, give it back. But I don't know that I've had anyone ask for layaway money back, you know, to this point, knock on wood. They, like you said, they're happy to be working towards something.
Yeah. I mean, how many lawyers in Nashville or any region are doing layaway? I mean, one out of 100, if that.
Few.
I mean,
very few,
One out of 50, you know, 25 tops lawyers are doing unbundled or even offering a payment plan in the first place. One out of 100 are doing layaway. And it really just, a lot of people, like you said, are just so grateful to have an opportunity to start working with a lawyer with, you know, only a few $100 to get started, and they're just making payments towards where they need to go.
And they may pay you forever, but if you get a good feeling about them, and that's something you learn too. I mean, yes, with payments, you know, maybe you set up a risk that you're getting burned at the end of some cases, and, you know, you can try to do certain things. But that, again, is you know, part of growing as a lawyer, whether you're with Unbundled or not, is who's going to stick it to you at the end and trying to avoid that person and being able to sniff them out. And, you know, the single mom or even the single dad who's, you can see them, they got two jobs. They're not great jobs. They're working all the time. That guy will probably pay you. You know, the person accused of being a drug addict and 7 addresses and has a child protective services case, probably don't lay away them, right? That's everybody. I mean, you got to get some gut for it, or, you know, there's probably some engineering undergrad who says you don't need a gut. You can do a 12-point checklist. Fine. My 12-point checklist is, I think, in my gut. This guy's going to pay me. This lady's not going to pay me. And I'm not always right, but I'm right enough that I can be profitable doing that.
Yeah. Yeah. And again, we've said this before, but I mean, what most lawyers fail to take into account is not the ones that don't pay, but it's all the ones that do pay now. You know, it's like,
right.
Forget.
Sure. Okay. Yeah.
You take a lawyer that's a $5,000 retainer up front, he's going to probably convert one out of 20 leads. Well, if you offer and bundle a payment plan, you're probably going to get three, four out of 10. But hey, if you do layaway two, now all of a sudden you got 5, 6, 7, 8 out of 10 pulling the trigger. That's a lot of increased revenue. And so when you start to, even if a few clients start to pull, start to pull out or don't make the payments, it's, you know, it's a small fraction of the folks that now can. And again, When you talk about referral sources,
if you got 20, 30 people paying you $100 a week, even with, you get a week or two with nothing new, it's something different that I like. I wasn't in that spot before, with the regular retainer structure. And now I am. I got all kinds of people on payment plans, and Tuesdays and Fridays, I think pretty much our money comes in, and you see it. And a few of them fail and a few people's things bounce every week, but mostly people pay you and you're doing work and they got money coming in, and it's pretty nice. I'll be honest with you. I'm starting to have some crying children. I know we were going to wrap this up. I'm going to let us go ahead and do that if it's all the same to you.
Let's do it, man. I am glad that we got to wrap up layaway. So thanks again for taking the time to jump on today, Aaron. And for everyone else who's listening, thanks so much for participating in the podcast.
We certainly appreciate your support.
Share with folks around that might benefit.
And we'll see you all in the next episode.
Sounds great. Thank you.
Okay.
For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.